At the risk of going through the nauseating revision of what the Liberals' party went through last week, from the time of the Ignatieff Ray wars and their false piety of puffed up hurt leading into the leaders' debate, it's enough. It's really enough from this party. But there's an important part of what happened last week that we need to review a bit, and it still makes me angry. We're used to hypocrisy in politics. We're used to cover-ups. We're used to denial. We lived through it so many times over the past 5 to 6 years, and even before that. But to me, this still sticks in my craw. The words and the images we saw last week have to give us pause and demand some commentary, and I want you people out there to think about it. We hear a lot of nonsense in this country. We take ourselves far too seriously for a nation of 30 million with 11, 12 governments, provincial and federal. We're over-governed, over-bureaucratized. But sometimes there's clarity. Sometimes we see the nonsense. And the only words last week that were more hypocritical and egregiously offensive to the civility of political discourse in Canada than Michael Ignatieff's declaration that war crimes were committed by Israel at Qana were the puffed-up false pieties of Bob Rae defending the Liberals and demanding an apology from Prime Minister Harper for accusing the former natural governing party of an anti-Israel bias. The thing is that Rae and the chattering class talking heads around him even had the temerity to state that because Rae had a Jewish grandfather and his wife is Jewish, Rae could not possibly have an anti-Israel bias. Yet it has been Rae and the salon liberals of media and academe, who remain his most ardent defenders, who have for years argued that being critical of Israel does not imply that one is necessarily anti-Jewish. Therefore, one would think that a former Rhodes scholar like Mr. Rae would easily understand the corollary, that being Jewish does not necessarily imply that one is free of anti-Israel bias. Plenty of people like Noam Chomsky and Professor Norman Finkelstein are just two examples to prove the point. Blood doesn't get you a get-out-of-jail-free card on this one. For Ray to dissent using blood as an intellectual argument is an insult to Canada. But the reiteration by Ignatieff of his original charge against Israel, followed by continued calls by Ray and Ignatieff that the Prime Minister's statement was crass politics, and that he should apologize ad injury to the original insults of both these candidates who have demonstrated that they remain firmly wedded to the politics of divide and conquer by means of the lowest common denominator. But then the Liberals have perfected this art in the past several years, and Ray and Ignatieff, being the former roommates they are seem to be set to take this duplicity to yet a higher level. Support for Israel and equitable consideration of its actions should have nothing to do with blood or politics or pandering. It should be driven by a national moral courage to stand with the friend of freedom abroad and not distort doctrine and truth in order to pander to political expediences at home. It should be driven by an equal standard of judgment and not by the double standards of moral relativism and political equivalency that liberal leaders have applied to the Middle East far too often and for far too long. This moral courage is the stuff of a leader, the stuff of national conscience and character. Something that neither Mr. Rae nor Mr. Ignatieff have demonstrated. The Prime Minister has, time and time again. Mr. Harper was right. And if there's any apology that he may well owe, it's not for stating the obvious fact that the current Liberal leadership candidates have an anti-Israel bias, as was demonstrated by Mr. Rae's calls for Israel to stop the fighting, even as frontline Arab states were quietly encouraging Israel, as was demonstrated by one of Jerry Kennedy's main supporters, Boris Obyshynski, when he went to Lebanon and said that Israel had practiced state terror. Now, the apology, my friends, is not one that Mr. Harper owes to the Liberals. The apology is that owed by the government of Canada to all freedom-loving citizens who time and again have seen a sister democracy betrayed, denigrated, and humiliated. Whether it was Mr. Martin calling Muammar Gaddafi a man with a philosophical bent of mind, whether it was former Foreign Minister John Manley equating Israeli self-defense with Palestinian terror in Damascus, whether it was former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien standing in Jerusalem and saying, I don't know, north from south or east or from west, or whether it was the hundreds of anti-Israel resolutions that Canadian ambassadors to the UN voted for on instructions of Liberal governments. But then the longest-serving prime minister of this Liberal Party, the black-souled William Lyon Mackenzie King, set the tone of the politics of nullification and interposition that is so perfected by today's Liberal Party, when he supported the call of none is too many as the acceptable Canadian quota for Jews escaping Hitler's Europe. Well, Canada, Mackenzie King would be proud of his party today, but not many more of us should be. We'll be right back with our first guest to discuss all this in a moment. And just before we go to our first guest to dissect the whole Liberal conundrum and flip-flops and what that means for this country, let's just go to Carol, who's been waiting patiently through my commentary. Carol, good evening.
Oh, good evening to you, Beryl. Always nice to hear you.
Nice to be heard.
I want to brush off a word on the Liberals. As far as I'm concerned, they can only dissolve into oblivion, because the way I look at it, Bob Rae, I like the way he answered back to Ignatieff, but to me, I put them on the same wavelength. They're not to be trusted.
Well, I mean, Rae, we're going to hear more from our first guest, who's one of the keenest observers in this country. Rae, NDP, Liberal. What he did to Ontario, we know. I mean, this fellow is accusing Ignatieff for changing his mind on Israel, but from the time the war started, he called for proportionality, he called for nuance, he supported Bill Graham's views. I mean, where is he getting off saying he doesn't have an anti-Israel bias? But we're going to get more into that, and we hope you enjoy this first discussion, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
There aren't many people in this country that know it better, understand it more, and really know what's going on behind every nook and cranny. And it's our pleasure always when Raymond Hurd joins us, former editor of the Montreal Star, head of CanWest News. Rae Hurd from Toronto, welcome.
Okay.
And I hear before you're going to vent your spleen on the Liberal flip-flops, you've got some breaking news from Toronto.
Well, I put it this way. There was blood flowing in the Liberal leadership debate, but at One Yonge Street, which is the headquarters of the Toronto Star, blood is flowing tonight. They have dismissed as the publisher Michael Goldblum, who, as your viewers, many of them know, is a Montrealer.
Yes, he was publisher of the Gazette.
Publisher of the Gazette and head of the YMCA, I think. He didn't do a good job at the Star. It declined under his leadership. They've brought in someone, the first woman publisher, whose name is Jagoda Pike, who happens to be a native of Croatia. And they've also fired the editor-in-chief, Giles Gershon, who has been around politics and journalism. I don't think it's going to change much. I think the Star, where I once toiled, will remain politically correct and, as I said earlier, the Bible of liberalism in Canada.
Well, capital L liberalism.
No. Yeah, capital L.
That paper has often been called the Liberal Party at prayer. Is that part of its problem?
Well, I think today they have lost track of their readers. The National Post, which has had some tough times like startups, is gaining circulation now. The Sun, which is owned by the Peladeaux, is losing circulation rapidly, and the Star is sort of static. The good news is that the Post is making yardage. That's good news. Now, to go to the debate.
Before we leave that, where's the Globe going in the latest figures?
The Globe's doing okay, but the National Post is gaining circulation. It's feisty. It calls a spade, and it is gaining circulation in Toronto, and that helps with advertising.
Sometimes, I think I can't imagine what this country would be like if we didn't have a National Post with the collection of the clearest and some of the most courageous voices around. It almost reminds me of, when The New Yorker had the best writers in America from the 30s to the 50s. The Post is quickly becoming an institution, and I would hope that all Canadians would support it.
I think increasingly, its feistiness is what sells. I like to think, when I was at the Montreal Star, we used to have feistiness, and unpredictability is also important in journalism today.
Well,
now,
you
the
had
Star
to bet.
Lost that. I started on the Toronto Star, so I can remember the good days. But thank God you have a Post to give Canadians a choice. That's the important thing.
That is true. That is very, very true. So what do you think of these Liberals? Do they have any consequence for Canada anymore, Rae?
Here's what I think. I was communications director for John Turner, and he had one issue, which was free trade, and He fought it hard, and he lost gracefully, and he's a friend of Brian Mulroney today. They are combined in their loathing for Jean Chrétien. But
I'm not sure they're so thrilled with Paul Martin either.
No, they aren't. Well, poor Martin.
Although he wasn't there when Chrétien was doing his backstabbing of Turner.
No, they're all backstabbing. But the real issue everyone doesn't address about the debate here this weekend, the two most important issues weren't discussed. Number one, Korea has tested an atomic device. That means Canada has to join the United States to defend North America against hostile missiles launched by rogue states. That wasn't even mentioned. The other thing, to Scott Bryson's disgust, no one got into the economy. So when you listen to this debate or watched it, you see these people talking airy-fairy talk about theory, but nothing about the real world.
A lot of tree-hugging, no defense, no bucks. That's pretty tough if you're going to have Starbucks. Ray Hurd, stay with us. We're going to pay some bills. Be right back.
Okay.
And we're back with one of the keenest observers of the Canadian scene, Ray Hurd, former editor of the Montreal Star, head of CanWest, former head of CanWest News. Ray, before the break, you were talking about how the Liberals avoided the major issues in their debate, defense,
yeah,
money. Isn't this something, though, that we come to expect from Liberals? You know, Paul Martin names a Gomery Commission to look at one problem within the party. No commissions on human resources, $1 billion wasted. Gun registry, $2 billion. DND losing $200 million. Martin's own retroactive tax changes that allowed him to avoid $300 million.
And you should add the income trust fiasco.
That's just starting.
That was going to wipe out the savings of a lot of senior Canadians. They had to back off on that one.
You think Michael Ignatieff understood the nature of the party he was getting into when he came from Harvard? This is not to excuse his stupidity. But,
well,
you know, Ray's brother, John, is with Power Corp. So you figure Bob Ray was well-briefed on the shenanigans and the nonsense and the cover-ups.
I see it, Beryl. I see Bob Ray as a surrogate for Jean Chrétien and that crowd, okay? I can tell you this.
Paul Martin is a part of the same crowd. It all goes back to Paul Damer and John Ray.
Yeah. But if he wins the leadership, and right now I think Ignatieff's fading and it'll be Dion versus Ray.
God help
Kennedy
us.
Kennedy maybe is the third man. But the thing you've got to understand about Bob Ray, if he wins it, Stephen Harper will win most of Ontario. The trendy...
Oh, I think this is Stephen Harper's wet dream, is to run against Bob Ray.
Yeah, some people actually think the Demers are setting this up because they want Harper to win. I don't buy that theory.
I've never heard of a connection there, so I don't buy it either.
But the real issue is that on Bay Street, on St. James's Street in Montreal, companies have succession plans. The Liberal Party has not had a succession plan since Lester Pearson. And Paul Martin gets a lot of the blame for the fiasco we see, and the worst leader of the opposition in Canadian history is Bill Graham. He's the most indecisive person.
Just remarkable.
Wandering around the world, waltzing. So they need a leader, and there is a leader who could restore the Liberal Party, but he's not running. His name is Frank McKenna. Read the papers today. We'll go back to Korea.
And McKenna called today for Canada to get real and wake up and be part
real
of the normal
but
world.
Frank McKenna's making money at TD Bank. He doesn't want to run. I don't blame him. And I think the reason he doesn't want to run is he doesn't want to spend the next 6 years in Stornoway.
What'd you think of Ignatius flip-flops last week and Ray's puffed-up demands for apologies?
Let me tell you what I think about that. When I worked with John Turner, an honorable man, he always used to say to me, the most dangerous thing in politics is the flip-flop. Ignatieff has flipped and flopped so many times that I think Canadians don't trust him. When he's in Quebec, he says one thing. When he's in Ontario, he says the next thing. And then when he goes west, he has another thing to say. So this is the problem. In politics, you've got to be consistent.
That was an awful performance. But I don't know why I personally got riled by Bob Ray puffing up and throwing the blood issue into the air. He and his crowd, the lefty crowd, have always said, well, you can be anti-Israel without being anti-Jewish. So the corollary is true, too. The fact that you have Jewish blood does not make you have a lack of an anti-Israel bias. And this guy, since the Middle East war started, was the one candidate consistently calling for Israel to back down.
Exactly.
And now he's puffing himself up?
Well, it is not anti-Semitic for the Prime Minister of Canada to say that these guys are anti-Israel. They are anti-Israel. I think, again, the exception may be Scott Bryson.
Yes. I think the Prime Minister actually said Scott Bryson and Joe Volpe.
Scott Bryson, by the way, never left any party. The party he belonged to ceased to exist. I think one day Scott Bryson may restore the Liberal Party, but it's going to be a long haul. On Israel, he's consistent. On the missile question, he is consistent. He's the only one. And the real issue right now is how are these guys going to broker a deal? Don't underrate Dion or Kennedy in a brokered deal, because if Ignatieff has peaked, Ray can't go much further because Ontario doesn't trust the guy. We're going to see a dramatic convention. Don't forget, Trudeau was not leading at first. There are lots of things that can happen.
We got a long way to go, and as I said to you 10 days ago, we're going to be talking to you all the way through. Raymond Hurd from Toronto, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Bill. Bye.
Montreal will be back right after the news. We like to be disruptive here, both on the air. We like to be disruptive in our work at the Institute. We like to present unconventional wisdom in our magazine, Barricades. You've all heard the term disruptive technology in this world. Foreign Affairs even did a whole issue on it. Well, proudly and gladly, Montreal has a center of disruptive intelligence. And it seeks, among other things, to move Quebecers out of the statocratic stagnation that they're so wedded to. And that institution is called the Montreal Economic Institute. I recommend its website to you, IEDM.org, for some clear thinking. We've had a lot of guests on, some of their guest speakers that have been brought into Montreal. We've had one of their economists, Nathalie El-Grabli, who wrote La Face Cachée de Politique Publique. Tasha Kierden is former executive vice president, and they've done it again. The Montreal Economic Institute commissioned a Léger marketing poll that found that two-thirds of Quebecers, as compared to only 48% of Canadians, would be ready to accept a multi-tiered or a parallel system or access to faster health care as long as a public system of some kind was maintained. We're more ready than the rest of Canada. And we've always been sold a bill of goods by Quebec politicians that, no, this is not Le Modèle Québec. Well, the poll indicates that it is, that we'd be more favorable as Quebecers for opening access to private insurance for all medically required care rather than limiting access to simply three operations, which was the Quebec government's version of meeting the Chiouly decision's parameters. The government of Quebec is clearly lagging behind citizens on this issue. Rather than delay once again the inevitable reform to the health system, the government could have capitalized on the opening offered by the Supreme Court ruling. This is, without exaggeration, a missed opportunity. And those are brave and bold words, and are the words of the new president of the Montreal Economic Institute, Paul Daniel Muller, and we're very proud to welcome him tonight. Good evening, Mr. Muller.
Good evening, Beryl, and thank you for that introduction. I've never felt so proud to be called disruptive, but
disruptive is a good thing.
But the way you put it, it sounds great. And before we get into the gist of the subject, just let me say that indeed it is our mission to debunk some myths that have been going around for a number of years, and to offer the population different ways of seeing public policy issues. So that's what we've been trying to do on various issues, including health care.
The importance of this poll, I think, is clear. The political importance, and correct me if I'm wrong, but politicians in the past, let's say, 10 years, and you've certainly been at the highest levels, are so often afraid to move without a focus group, without a poll. Does this give them the courage to rethink the model?
Well, you'd have to ask Mr. Couillard that question, but obviously in this case the government, and I suppose the government has the same polls as we do, but obviously it has chosen to not move as far as the population would agree to on this issue of private insurance. So as you rightly said, two-thirds of Quebecers would be ready to open up private insurance to all procedures, and the government has chosen to limit those procedures to three for now. Now, perhaps in the future, perhaps after the next election, they would be ready to widen access further. But at this point, my understanding is that they're playing it safe.
You mentioned a very interesting notion just 30 seconds ago, you said the government has the same polls we do. We often have Conrad Wynn, who I think is one of the best pollsters in the country, president of Compass Polling, and one of his critiques of polls is that organizations such as yours normally commission a poll that has broader and deeper questions, whereas governments typically commission polls that are very narrow in the number of questions and not very wide, just sort of to dip their toe in and pull it out very quickly if the water's too cold. You think that's true of what Dr. Wynn says, that you can go deeper and that your polls are more reflective because of the money you're willing to spend and the questions you're willing to ask?
Well, I'm not sure I've spent enough time polling, you know, to be able to answer that question correctly. Really, we've been polling on this issue because we've been active on the in the issue for a
right.
number of years. We've been putting out papers for since the early 2000s on the the first years of this decade. On the importance of getting new types of funding into healthcare. We've been putting out research papers, and this poll is just sort of the latest contribution, our latest contribution to the issue. And
let's put aside for a second the political notions of this, that how ridiculous it is in our society. We're allowed to spend money on almost everything except on our own health. You know, and I've gone through this recently. I've experienced this just last year with a member of my family, and where we were encouraged by medical professionals to go into the parallel sector. We don't have two-tier, we have three-tier. But let's look at it from the standpoint of the economist like yourself. Is it tenable for a society that to spend 43 cents out of every dollar, I think it's 43, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, and ever-growing, not merely on healthcare needs, but on the growing bureaucracy? In other words, we have a government that is not just trying to be educative or it's trying to be compulsive, and it's creating this massive bureaucracy that is totally unneeded. Can Quebec be tenable going forward without a shift? And I would ask you to think about that just for one moment as I pay a bill here before Master Control goes a little crazy on me. So we'll be back in 45 seconds. And we're pleased tonight to have with us Paul Daniel Mueller, the new president of the Montreal Economic Institute, that commissioned and released today a study by Léger Marketing that showed that Quebecers are substantially more favorable to the idea of allowing citizens to spend their money on health care, private health care, parallel health care, call it what you will, as long as there's a certain public system in place. And in fact, the numbers in Quebec, and we've all been told and spoon-fed that the Quebec Inc., the Quebec model, is a status model. Well, Quebecers are over 60% in favor, while the rest of Canada is 48%. Paul, I asked you before the break, is it tenable for Quebec to continue as a society spending 43 cents of every dollar on health care with a burgeoning bureaucracy, and I think another 30 cents on education?
Yeah,
Can we continue?
Well, plainly the answer is no, because the 43%, so 43% of every program spending goes to health care currently. But 10 years ago, it was around 30%, and even then,
right,
people thought that it was too much. So over the past decade, the proportion of spending that's going to healthcare has risen about 10 points, and it's still rising about a point a year. So you can well imagine that means less money for education, for roads, and for all the other important things that the government wants to spend money on.
And things don't seem to be working, whether the transit system is in chaos, the healthcare problems we know about, the basic delivery of services of a society just doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, there are problems in a number of areas, but if we look at healthcare, it's obvious that the needs are still going up. You know, we have an aging population, more and more elderly people who are requiring healthcare services. And if we limit funding of the healthcare system to taxpayer dollars, I mean, it simply won't work. The math doesn't work. So we absolutely need to get other types of funding into the healthcare sector and not exclude private funding as we are currently doing. So Mr. Couillard's bill is a good step in the right direction, but a very timid step, in my view. Prudence would call for opening up the channels through which private monies can flow into the system and thus relieve some of the pressure that's being built up at this point. So that can happen through private insurance. It can happen through direct spending by patients who, as you rightly said before the break, value their health more than anything else. And all these monies can help relieve the pressure and help with the waiting times. So I think we need to do a reality check here and realize that we need some pretty substantial reform.
I think before you and I are called ogres for even daring to discuss this on air, I just want to throw some figures out to the listening public about what we're talking about. Many of the private clinics that have opened in Montreal, and this is an anomaly that Quebec is actually the leader in private clinics, charge about $100 for a full workup, $120 for a full examination. Scans in private clinics will run $300 to $400. Now, these are not inconsequential figures, but we're not talking about the major procedures, and we're not talking about thousands of dollars. But coming back to what you said earlier, Paul, about the timidity factor, there's been a criticism of the Liberal government in Quebec. There were great hopes for it when it came in. It ran on a non-interventionist statist model and really has turned out to be more mercantilist than non-interventionist or ready to roll back the role of the state. And one of the criticisms has been that when Margaret Thatcher, and one of the parallels has been that when Margaret Thatcher and Keith Joseph came into power in Britain, they held a very famous press conference, and a reporter asked Mrs. Thatcher, how are you going to roll back 30, 40 years of Labour policies? And she held up Friedrich Hayek's Constitution of Liberty, slammed it on the table, and said, this is what we believe. There's a feeling in Quebec today that this government doesn't know what it believes, and the only alternative of a party that believes something are the PQ that's on the left and are still wedded to the statist model. Do you have that feeling that the Liberals need, well, maybe the Liberals need some brain trust from the MEI?
Well,
is there a plan out there, in other words, other than the Premier sitting around with a bunch of businessmen and nobody really having a macro plan for how to roll back the role of the state in their lives?
Well, they certainly came in with a plan. Now, the electorate will have to judge at the end of their mandate if that plan has been accomplished or not. For sure, organizations like ours are ready to supply alternative ways of delivering public services, cheaper ways, ways that include market incentives for better efficiency, that include different ways to fund public services through not only through taxation but also through private funds. So we can supply the ideas, but we're not the elected bunch, right? The government is elected. And they are the ones that can carry out these ideas.
They're elected, but don't you feel more and more that NGOs are important? That's where a lot of creative thinking goes on. Those are the cauldrons, the crépuscule, where thoughts get accomplished today. Government seems so sclerotic sometimes.
Indeed, think tanks are good places to develop new ideas. In Quebec, we're just about the only think tank who's putting forth free market policies, and of course we need all the support we can get. We're entirely privately funded. We receive no government funding, and that's our mission. You know, and I think we're carrying it out. But generally speaking, think tanks are there to put out those ideas and sometimes be disruptive, as you mentioned earlier on.
And you're doing a good job of that, and I would recommend to our listeners IEDM.org. MEI puts out reports, economic notes. They do conferences. They have speakers. They help publish this book, La Face Cachée de Politique Publique, which even if you need a dictionary, go get it. There's not an English version out yet. And Paul Daniel Mueller, we thank you for being with us tonight. And with the kind of words that you used today, we look forward to bold leadership and more bold leadership from the MEI and the continuing tradition.
Thank you. We'll certainly continue.
Thank you, Paul.
Good evening.
We'll be right back. You know, this nation nominally pledges allegiance to the survival and success of liberty. You'd think that would imply a certain fidelity to sister democracies, a certain strength of courage for people struggling for freedom. And until Prime Minister Harper's election, we didn't have any of that spirit. We weren't told those glorious words. We weren't involved in mankind's struggles for redemptive change. For many, many years, one of the great ironies is that despite our talk of happy encounters, in history. Canada's record after World War II has not been, after Korea, has not been that great. And one of the saddest moments of the West generally is being remembered this week as the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution, the revolt against Soviet domination. Nobody can forget the faces of brave young people in the streets of Budapest facing Soviet tanks with nothing but machine guns. It was almost reminiscent of Warsaw Ghetto, not to draw a parallel, but a few brave souls. The 1956 Hungarian Rebellion, of course, was crushed, but it led to a remarkable outpouring of talent out of that country and into Canada. And that talent and that memory has been celebrated in newspapers all through the weekend. And we're going to talk a little about that now with one of our regular callers who knows a lot about where Canada should be given where he came from. Andy, welcome.
Good evening. Well, the thing is this, the 56th Revolution, unfortunately, you might not realize that it was dead when it started.
I think a lot of people there knew that, but I think they would rather have lived a day as a lion than a lifetime as a lamb.
Yeah. You see, Nadim Bre, who was the prime minister at that time, even he knew that it cannot succeed for a certain reason. Although the idea of getting rid of, let's say, communism, the Soviet dictatorship and everything was very honorable and decent. But what happened was that he couldn't control the crowd. He couldn't control the people, and people started acting militarily. And this is what made it so bloody. And at the same time, remember, United States of America had no intention of helping Hungary.
No.
Because of the Yalta Conference.
Do you think Dubček was better in 67 in the Prague Spring in terms of control? But although he still, of course, was toppled by the Russians again, lasted longer. Was that because of political organization? Was that because he was a center of the crowd's attention, of the population's esteem?
Yeah, but the thing is, there was no the hatred of the Hungarian people, a certain section of Hungarian people against communism was so much that even Nagy Imre, I heard this today on the Hungarian, on internet radio, that when Nagy Imre went on to talk to the people, he still called them comrades, for which he was booed. But he knew that the violent confrontation was an impossibility. And the Hungarian Revolution turned very sour because there was no true leadership. And the mob mentality took over, killing started, and they attacked the forces. Any normal person knows that you cannot fight Soviet Union militarily at that time.
In light of what you lived through and saw in Europe,
I saw.
How depressing is Canadian leadership in foreign policy until the election of Prime Minister Harper? Well, how depressing was it to you? And this current debate about joining America in the ballistic missile shield, why do we have problems with it?
We have problems because generally Canadians and even Americans are the most naive people in the world.
They don't believe that there is evil out there.
Oh,
it's
no,
not necessarily not. Black and white and how to deal with it, but North Americans have a problem understanding evil.
To be honest with you, the only prime minister up to now that has any guts is Stephen Harper. No, I'll be honest with you at the same time, because I had sort of somehow akin favoritism to the Liberals. But the last four elections, I actually could not vote Liberal because I saw that it didn't mean anything when they get in, what they say, what they did. At least a political leader like Harper has to take a stand.
He's at least brought up the level of public discourse. Andy, we ran out of time. I thank you for your time. I want to thank Nick Mays of Master Control, and I want to leave all of you with a thought about the nonsense that you saw yet last week with the flip-flops with Ignatieff and Ray, a thought about this 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution. If you will not fight for right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when your victory is sure and not too costly, you may come to the moment when you will have to fight with all the odds against you and only a precarious chance of survival. There may even be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory, because it is better to perish than to live as slaves. And those great words were said by Winston Churchill. think and reflect on them tonight. We'll be back with you tomorrow.